There's a particular kind of work that doesn't always look like struggle from the outside. It looks like court cases, policy submissions, legal arguments, constitutional reasoning. But inside it, it often feels like something else entirely, a constant negotiation between what the law promises and what life can actually hold. Today, we're speaking to an organization that has spent the past 16 years in that space between rights on paper and reality on the ground. And we're asking a simple question, but uncomfortable one. When you spend your life expanding rights, what kind of nation are you actually building? And who gets to decide? Joining me in the studio today is the Executive Director of SERI, the Socioeconomic Rights Institute, that's based in Johannesburg and works at the junction of advocacy, research and litigation, in particular when it comes to access to housing and making a living in the informal sector. Nomzamo Zondo, welcome. So your open letter is what really caught my mind. And it got me thinking about the work that you do very differently. I hadn't thought about it in that way. And you wrote in your work that SERI's work can be summed up in two words: nation building. And for South Africa and South Africans, that's a very loaded phrase. So help us understand what it is that you mean by that.
Yeah, so I'm glad that at least you're coming at me with excitement. But as you can see from my eyes, it's not. It's a very deep place. And I think, one, the idea of a nation in South Africa, one nation on this land, is quite new, right? Less than 32 years old. So that's the first place. But for me, the reason I went to that nation building is that at that time, 1990, probably 94, 96, we gave definition to what we want to do and the kind of nation we want to be. And I think for me, as a lawyer who's committed to movement lawyering, who works with communities that are struggling for the better South Africa, I've always understood my place only as the lawyer. I was never able to see that I'm actually a piece in the puzzle, right? Or a cog in the wheel. And the wheel that many of the movement's clients that we work with are trying to move is a wheel of a South Africa where their humanity is recognized. Secondly, a South Africa that kind of honors what was built pre-94, the visions, the hope of what it can be to be a Black person whose humanity is fully recognized and whose needs are met.
No.
And so when those two words came up, nation building, it was precisely that actually we are driving, for us, we are driving towards a destination. We might be losing ground. We might think we are, for instance, 1,000 kilometers away, and we've taken a few turns and are now 1,500 kilometers away. But for us, what SERI does and what its clients and partners are trying to do is get to the South Africa that I was speaking about earlier.
So, you say as a lawyer, and it's how you've always looked at it. And I'm wondering, because a big part of what your work is in litigation, right? So when you say nation building, do you think that this is something that the courts are doing, or is this something that the communities are living through?
So it's very interesting because law has always been central in defining South Africa. So we all know we lived through apartheid, which was basically law being used to subjugate other people. But when we decided to have a new nation, we then decided to write a constitution that would almost be like a journal to these are what our dreams are. It's a journal, it sits there. And then I would have hoped that we would go back every now and again and say, are we still on track? But in that process, one, first of all, the courts have been appointed as the people who oversee whether we are still traveling towards the vision in the journal. The people are the ones who firstly put up the vision, but are also the ones who are actually living daily, either the victory from having that vision met? Or, of course, what is probably a more familiar picture of what that failure means? And so the courts are important, the people are important. But then we have on this side, maybe two, the way as lawyers we see it, there's three parts of government. There is the legislature, which tells us what the law is and is meant to oversee the executive, which is the one that's meant to implement the laws as we've agreed to them. And then the courts are supposed to be sitting there telling the executive, no, you're going the wrong direction. This is actually the direction you should be going to. And the people are actually the only ones at this point who are going to the courts to say, wait a minute. The president is not doing his job right now. The Minister of Human Settlement is not doing her job right now. The Mayor of Johannesburg is not doing his job right now. And in that way, we're drive towards that vision.
So when you win a case, what changes the next day for a person involved in that case?
It depends. Multiple things. So one, for instance, for someone who's being evicted, the first thing that changes is not having to worry about where their children will sleep in 2 weeks' time, or when the sheriff comes. Just the worry. In a case, we can address that worry. Secondly, at times, when we win cases, we change the perspective of people. So another example, we act for domestic workers. It's actually the hardest we've had to work on winning people on perspectives, because even though we act for a vulnerable a group that people can actually empathize with, but it's also a group that no one will take action for. So you have domestic workers, their employers won't even pay minimum wage, won't comply with laws. And our fight has simply been to get the public to buy into the fact that domestic work is work. And in the same way that at your workplace, you expect your employer to pay you on time, to meet the terms of the contract, that's what you have to do. And then I think I can probably share some examples of our work where you can see what the impact is. There is an informal settlement in Philippi in Cape Town. It's called Marikana.
It took me a while.
It's called Marikana. 60,000 people live there. But when we started participating in that case, we're participating as lawyers for the amicus in the case, Abahlali baseMjondolo, who at that time, I think, had a small base in the Western Cape, were strong in KZN, but understood the experience of people there who were having a problem with the anti-land invasion unit of the city of Cape Town coming in and demolishing their homes. That's when we started that work in 2014. As we sit today in 2026, the city of Cape Town, I think last year, bought the pieces of land from the private property owners. And that land is now meant to eventually become permanent homes for the people in that community, 60,000 people.
So, I mean, that raises quite a lot of questions for a person on the outside looking in, right? And that particular Cape Town and Philippi, the city of Cape Town and Philippi, is something that has been on the news for over 10 years. We've been watching it, and it really has become a bit of a template for how cities respond. And I'm interested in understanding a little bit about, you know, the way that Siri works, and if you feel that you're responding to crisis, from crisis to crisis. And if you recognize that you're shaping long-term urban policy as well, and if there's a space in between.
Yeah, so, I mean, when you spoke earlier, you said most of our work is litigation. SERI uses three methods: litigation, research, and advocacy. And our research and advocacy work is less visible, but in effect, it's probably as close in terms of work output. And in that work, the key part of that work is, for instance, policy advocacy and engaging the state. Engaging the state not simply in the way that you'd see it in litigation, where it's where there's a almost an aggressive stance between us trying to protect clients and working in a crisis, to us actually trying to get the Department of Human Settlements to understand that its role is to empower municipalities to execute the Housing Act. SERI's work, actually, the one thing, whenever I go to international conferences, I always share this, that when it comes to our policies, our laws, most of them are a dream to every other housing practitioner, to every other housing lawyer, but the problem is implementation. And so in the work that we're doing on our research and advocacy part side, we are, first of all, trying to engage the state so that they understand how their existing policies meet the lived experiences of our clients. But beyond that, we are also trying to show them how the lack of implementation of those policies is undermining the rights of people. And also,
so, you know, while you think about that, I mean, that therein lies the tension, really, right? Between what the Constitution imagines, you said it's like a journal of what we envisage, and what cities can actually absorb.
Yo. No. No, it's because the way that you framed it, right? You framed it as what cities can actually absorb, right? And our experience, even as recent as last week, is that municipal officials, municipal office bearers are refusing to accept the obligations placed on them by the Constitution. And so this issue of absorption is less about actually the capacity of cities, but actually more about the lack of political will. And I spent a day, being unfair, I spent half a day in a meeting of the South African Local Government Association. And in that day, the whole day was spent on them saying, we don't want to have this obligation. And it was beautiful because all the lawyers were all singing from one tune of, but you have it, please accept it. So it's not a matter of absorption.
So you think it's a matter of political will not being there?
Yo.
So have the courts then become, by default, and SERI as the driver, the new town planners?
I don't think so, right? I don't think so, because I think the planning is not happening when the courts make a decision. And the planning is not happening probably even when the city writes up their plan. The planning is happening as people live, right? And that's also very important, because people see SERI. They don't see the people of Philippi. They don't see the people of Enkanyezi. They don't even see the people of the inner city of Johannesburg. They see SERI, an organization of 28 employees that is moving, as you're saying, our special planning. But actually, that organization of 28 employees is not the one that put Marikana there. Marikana was there, and all we did was represent the residents of Marikana. And so what the courts are doing, and SERI through our representation, is facing our government to do what the Constitution promises that they will definitely do, which is govern respecting the will of the people.
Respecting the will of the people looks different from different people's perspectives. And I think for a lot of listeners, for a lot of people who are not in the informal living spaces, the tension that they have to grapple with really in a lot of the work that you do is also what it means. Does this work rely on protecting dignity, or is it entrenching informality?
So our work on evictions, since SERI was founded in 2010, has made one call, and one call only. If you are going to evict, please provide alternative accommodation where people have the same access, right? And so If that first, let's say the first call we made in 2010 was answered, those people would have been out of informality into formality. We know that even beyond the failures of implementation, that we cannot plan to respond as rapidly as we are urbanizing, right? So that's one point. The second point, which I think is important, which I wanted to make, is that the people who, the different places where we sit, and I'm fortunate because you and I probably sit in the same place. We are known by the formal property market. The deeds registry knows who we are. We probably have our name there. But over 2/3 of people in South Africa have insecure tenure or have their tenure not registered anyway. So the question of what then our work must mean, for me, it's important that our work responds to the majority of people in South Africa, number one. Two, that it responds to those who are most vulnerable. And that's what the courts have been saying consistently over and over again, that actually as the state, yes, it's great that you're planning to provide permanent housing down the line, but please make plans. 2001, please make plans to attend to those in urgent crisis today.
So then there's another pressure that builds. And I think the way you framed it in your letter, when you spoke about nation building, is really not only about housing. It's also about belonging. And thinking most recently of your, shall I say, run-in with organizations like Operation Dudula, right? Can then constitutional protections live side by side with this rising social tension of people who are feeling excluded as well, and a tension for available resource? How do you maintain that balance?
Yeah, so I mean, it's really important that you've raised this point. So our run-in, the interesting thing about it was that the run-in was on the back of a case that is brought by four organizations, four movements. Actually, as you also pointed out, one of them organizes informal traders, so not housing. One of them simply organizes around the issue of xenophobia and migrant sentiment. But in that case, one, you have Abahlali, who has over 100,000 members, who themselves are poor, who know exactly what it means to stand in the line in the Deben CBD in a clinic. Probably they will say, unlike me or unlike you, right? And Operation Dudula was saying, we also stand in the very same... We stand in the very same place, and we feel that these people are encroaching on our rights as citizens to access healthcare or to access education. And I think Abahlali, in fact, even before the march, the day of the march, had said, let's have a conversation in closed doors. President Sibusiso Gode called Zandile Dabula and said, let's meet face to face and let's talk this out. Tell me a day and a time. And of course, then it would have been leaders. At the end of the day, the membership of Dudula and maybe the membership of Abahlali wouldn't be there. But I know that the way that Abahlali works, there would be a time when you've gotten to that conversation. So maybe let me put that aside. The question of available resources. It's such a difficult question to answer, because the one thing that we've struggled with is that the state has never actually gotten to the point of saying, here is what we have. We've spent this for the flag. We've spent this for this. We've spent this for this, and we are stuck. I'll go to the specific example of healthcare. When the issue around Operation Dudula was heating up, the Department of Health itself stood up and said, problems in our health sector, yes, there is an issue about migrants, but that is a minor issue compared to the issues we're having around corruption and this and this and this. And so Abahlali was calling on Dudula to say, let's join hands and fight to resolve these other issues. And then two, of course, you must understand, we're never going to understand violence as a language in any circumstance, in any situation. But let's have a conversation. And so in that, I think none of us, I think even the legal organizations that work in health are saying government shouldn't control who goes in, saying shouldn't limit the right of migrants in terms of how they access public health care. But everybody is saying, as the public, we should be staying out of it. And definitely there's no space for violence.
Well, I mean, looking as recently as yesterday, 2 days ago, in, what's the new name?
Kwakumbu. No, Kukompo. So I'm from the Eastern Cape. I didn't even know there's such a place. But yeah, Kukompo town.
I keep going, Kukompo what is City. This when I see this new name? But I mean, of course, you're also talking, when we talk about issues of violence, you're also talking about legal principle, right? But where do we draw the line between legal principles and social cohesion and what we see on the ground?
So I think one, you're right, it is an issue of social cohesion. So interestingly, in the case that we brought against Operation Tudula and several government departments, we're raising the government's failure to address issues of social cohesion. We've had xenophobia bubbling up since 2008. We have a plan, a national action plan that's meant to respond to issues of social cohesion, not only in relation to migrants, but also in relation to other groups within South Africa. And that plan is not being implemented. And so, yes, there's that one side. So we can put that aside. But on the issue of violence, I think all of us can accept that it has no space. It honestly doesn't. I don't think it's actually an issue of the law. I think it's also moral. For me, for instance, I remember one of the moments that felt quite personal for me was the idea that Operation Tudula would stand outside a school yard and engage with children, say you're a migrant child, you're not a migrant child. And for me, as a South African mother, whose children maybe might go through that same gate, and maybe they will not be mistreated, but just the idea and the possibility of them experiencing that.
Or even made being exposed to that.
No, exactly, being exposed to that. It made me cry. And that's why I'm saying there is no place for violence. And in fact, from the beginning, one of the things that we've been, that the Kopanang Africa Against Xenophobia has been calling for, is for the state to be present. Because it's probably fair that maybe the people of Kukompo town, the people in Operation Tudula might feel that they have to take action because they don't see the government taking action.
Speaking of the government taking action and the frameworks you spoke about, legislative arm, and the lawmaking process then that governs all of these things that you brush up against, do you think that it's the people's right to, when they make submissions on these laws, to have the legislator, to have the government listen to these responses and actually take them into consideration and change bills and change the way that they write these acts in response to how people are engaging with them?
So, I mean, one of the things which is in my open letter is about the fact that we made it, we took a conscious decision to receive Operation Tudula. We said we'll receive them. Even at the threat that they might be violent, in fact, in the end, they were violent, but we said we'd receive them. And we are a private, small, non-profit organization. For the state, that is their role. Their role is to listen to what the people feel and are angry about, and then they must take responsibility and take the necessary actions. And I'm saying this because I don't want to say it in a way that, I don't want to say it in a vacuum, so people might get confused. I say, we're already saying exclude all migrants, right? Because I want people to know that up until I was maybe like 10 years old, I was a migrant in South Africa, and I had to cross. My grandmother had to put my name on her passport for me to cross in Nciba. And if my name wasn't on a passport, there'd be problems for me to go back to my home, which was a township in the Eastern Cape. And so this idea of migrants, yes, right now, we might say we are deciding this. And we must understand that we are the white men in the room. The people that are saying that?
That's loaded.
That's loaded, yes. So the white man in the room is the person who has all the privileges and who is considered by everyone in this context. But in this very same room, there's a rural African woman. And so when we say these things of, we want all migrants gone, right? I promise you one, the migrants that we are talking about are the ones who are poor. That I promise you. In fact, Operation Tula keeps saying it over and over again. Those with money, please, you are welcome. Two, the migrants that they are talking about are the ones actually who are not really the threat, even as we sit now in this process about the criminal justice system and its integrity, are not the one who have powers to make sure that our ports are so porous that they bring in drugs. They're not the ones who have powers even to make sure who's standing in the corner is doing what. They are not those migrants. Those migrants are sitting probably a few blocks from us here, chilling in a penthouse. The migrants that are being identified as a problem are not the ones that will be solved by the solution. And so for me, I want us to have that picture firstly, but two, to then ask ourselves, why did we say in the preamble of the Constitution, South Africa belongs to all who live in it? And I promise you, it's because we knew what it is to be in a country and not be seen as belonging in it. We know what it is to be a second-class citizen. I mean, fairly, many people might say that they're experiencing that second-class citizenship even now. But I think we know it in a way that is probably as brutal as groups like Operation Tula would want it to be, where people were burnt and their shoes were set on fire because they found themselves on a certain part of town after a certain hour. That is our experience. It's our experience that there are places in this country that we can't access, that we should not even dare to walk, you know?
So you talk about, in your letter, you also talk about nation building. And the thing that I kept thinking about, do you think that this nation that you say Siri is in the work of building, do you think it is the same nation that our politicians are governing over, are themselves building?
I'm quite certain that it's not. I'm quite certain that the work that we are doing is reminding them every day that they have an obligation to govern, to build that nation. But I also never want to be unfair. I think there are moments, right? And we can think about just after the COVID-19 outbreak, there are moments when you can see the politicians remembering who we are. And I'm not saying it in the way when they sing songs in parliament. I'm saying in the way when they make decisions, we'll now have a grant to provide for those who are unemployed. We are a country which says it shouldn't matter what the income of your family is. If you are going to go to that school, you should only pay as much school fees as you are able to. We are that country. And those things, so at the level, and I've said earlier, on a level of legislation, we are mostly that country. At the level of implementation, no. And I take it as Nomzamo, as my personal crusade, especially in 2026, as we celebrate 30 years of that constitution, to remind everyone that that is the nation we should be building.
So do you think there is a point at which legal advocacy must concede to its limits? not just in principle, but in capacity.
So interestingly, in the open letter, I share a memory, which is not my own, a memory of Jackie Dugard, who's a co-founder of SERI. And Ujeki, she speaks about one of the painful losses in the Constitutional Court. And she said she rushed out of court in tears and she calls one of the clients. And she's kind of saying, I'm sure she was kind of saying, I failed. We've lost the case. And the client's like, For us, the struggle continues. And SERI's work, legal advocacy, our research, our policy advocacy is about enabling the people to take that struggle forward. We fully accept the limits of the legal process. And in effect, my hope is for one day to be useless as a lawyer. My hope is for the government who doesn't need me to translate what the Constitution should mean. My hope is for the government to know what the poor needs and to act for it. My colleagues at SERI don't want to be running urgents, don't want to be even themselves butting heads about what's the right legal strategy. They would rather that a poor community in the Western Cape knows the city of Cape Town is this government. And they don't need to go past an office in Joburg for the city of Cambridge to do what is right.
So how then can we encourage the ordinary citizen? How can we encourage people to make their voices heard?
I think something that we've lost is people being organized. So when we grew up, as the older people in the room, there were civics. Everybody was involved in civics.
Street committees.
There were trade unions, exactly. There were trade unions, people were in trade unions. There were organizations within schools, and people were engaged in those. And so my challenge to anyone, if you care about anything, find someone, one person, to discuss that thing with. And then find a mobilized group that is working on resolving that issue. That is all that I ask. Because if we do that, then we can contribute together to this nation building.
I think that's wonderful. I think that's a good place to end.